Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor. Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app.
Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.
From 2400 Sports, Odyssey, and Major League Baseball, this is the PBP Voices of Baseball.
We bring you the people who bring you the game.
Welcome in, my baseball people. Hope everyone is great, thoroughly enjoying another season of the ball games and another season of the PBP Voices of Baseball. Just as the games themselves are a companion to our lives for 6 months or so, so too can this podcast. Have spoken with a few listeners who listen to us in the mornings while they make their coffee, maybe toast a bagel, what have you. Go about your life, go about your business, and hang out with us as we learn about play-by-play and talk to the people that bring us the game. Eric Nadell is the goods, and you will hear why in this conversation. You'll hear a Nolan Ryan highlight. You'll hear a full circle story involving a World Series collapse and a World Series win. The relief in Eric's voice when the Rangers finally do win the World Series, well, a ton of fan bases can relate to that. Our guest is one of three working broadcasters who have been with their teams for 40 years or more. It's Bob Uecker up in Milwaukee, Denny Matthews with the Royals, and this man, Eric Nadell, a Ford Frick Award winner in 2014, the fifth award winner and Hall of Famer that we have had on this show, with at least one more coming later this season. We started the conversation by asking Eric if winning that award has had a lasting effect on his career. You sound and appear far too youthful to have been with the Rangers for 40 years. It's more than 40 now, right? But you're part of a very exclusive 40 years, one ball club. Do you know how many of you exist in the world?
Well, right now, among active announcers, I believe we're talking about Denny Matthews and Bob Uecker and me. I think that's currently it.
That is amazing. And when you got the Ford Frick Award in 2014, are you the youngest who's ever gotten that award?
No, actually, I think Marty Brenneman, I believe, was the youngest when he won it back in the late 70s. And John Miller, who's exactly the same age as I am, won it about 5 years before I did. So he would have won it, 5 years younger than I was when I won it.
Got you. Talked to Pat Hughes last year on this show as he went in. Joe Castiglione is a guest on the show this year. What did that mean, and what has it had a lasting effect on you to be in the Hall of Fame and part of that fraternity here a decade later?
It's really kind of surreal, Matt. I grew up listening to Red Barber and Mel Allen in New York. I grew up in Brooklyn, and the Dodgers moved when I was six. I had started listening to games and going to games, but I don't remember Vin Scully at all. I do remember Mel Allen and Red Barber doing those Yankee games, though, and they were the first two winners of the Ford Frick Award. Then when I was 11 years old, the Mets started out, and Lindsey Nelson and Bob Murphy were their announcers, and they've won the Frick Award. So those were the guys who were really responsible for me, getting excited about doing this and wanting to do this from the time I was a kid. And for me to win an award, that those guys have won, and to have my picture be on the same wall with them, it almost doesn't seem right. It's almost like there should be a different category for guys like that than, for guys like me who've come along, so many years later. But it's just a tremendous honor. I can't imagine, any better honor than, for your peers and the former winners of that award, to have voted that award for me.
You know, those names that you mentioned kind of loom over the entirety of play-by-play. And a lot of us know Mel Allen from, now it's time for Twib Notes from around the American League, right? We grew up on him as on This Week in Baseball. What was Mel like as a broadcaster to your young ears? What came out that sparked you?
He was incredibly warm and friendly. That was the first thing that struck me, starting from the way he opened the broadcast with this, you know, that little Southern accent that he had and a very big smile in his voice when he said, "Hello there, everybody." And I just loved him. You know, I really thought he was my friend. It was so welcoming that really set the tone for the broadcast. Red Barber, who was his partner, was much more low-key, much less warm, but he also opened the broadcast in a very friendly manner. In fact, he used to say, "Hi, friends, Red Barber here," and he actually called you friends. And I felt those guys were my friends. You know, I'm 7, 8, 9 years old listening to these games, really feeling like I was hanging out with these guys at the ballpark. Wondering how they got off work. That's really how I got interested in this. I asked my dad one day how they got off work to go do that afternoon game at Yankee Stadium. My dad, who was a dentist, said, "Well, no, that's their job." And I said, "So you're going to go and fill some cavities next, and these guys go to Yankee Stadium and blah, 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 blah about it?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Dad, they've got a better job than you do." And ever since then, I've wanted to do this.
How'd that go over with Dad at the time?
Well, you know, he pointed out that at the time there were 16 teams, 8 in each league, so 32 jobs. And he thought that maybe I should choose something where my odds of success were a little bit higher.
he wasn't wrong mathematically, but
no.
he underestimated your drive and your eventual skills.
Yeah, he wasn't a big fan of the idea.
Yeah, well, you know, join the club, you know, like when those of us who've grown up as broadcasters of any kind at one point faced a parent who said, I'm paying for college for this. Really? That's what I'm doing.
Right.
It's amazing. So that friendliness, do you think about that? And have you thought about that when you do the job? Because we all go through whatever we're doing and the season can be whatever it is. But in the end, like, baseball is this companion sport. You're part of people's lives for 6 months. You've got to be somebody they want to hang out with.
I think about it all the time, Matt. I actually write on my scorecard in big red letters, "Smile and have fun," which to me is the single most important thing in connecting with the audience and getting the audience to feel like you're a guy they want to hang out with. It's really important for them to know that you're happy to be there, that you're having a good time. And you know, Mel Allen was a big factor there. The Mets announcers might have even been bigger factors because they were broadcasting a team that was absolutely horrible for the first several years. In that first year, they were 40 and 120. And yet Lindsey Nelson and Bob Murphy always sounded like there's no place in the world they would rather be. And they were really the voice of hope, you know, for a crummy team. They made it sound like every player on the Mets was an all-star. They made it sound, they would tell you that Choo Choo Coleman, the Mets catcher, was the best in the league at blocking low pitches. You know, well, he should have been because every other pitch was in the dirt. But they really have been an inspiration for me in the bad years that, you know, you can still have fun. You can still find a ray of hope, you know, in a bad season, in a bad game.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you can't be hopeful, if you can't have hope as the voice of the team, how can the fans have hope? And so that, you know, they've been a very big inspiration to me. And in the really bad seasons, and I've had plenty of them with the Rangers, you know, I've thought about those guys a lot. I thought about Herb Score a lot too, who did the Cleveland Indians for a long time when they were terrible. And when I first got this job in 1979, I asked Herb, you know, how do you do this? How do you keep your enthusiasm high when your team's out of contention by June? And he said, "I do the game in a vacuum. You know, I do today's game as a game between two major league teams featuring the best baseball players in the world. And I ignore the standings. I forget about the fact that the Indians are 20 games out of first place. I just do this game. This might be the best game I've ever seen. This might have the best play I've ever seen." This might have the weirdest thing that happens in a game that I've ever seen. So just enjoy that day's game and don't get dragged down by what happened yesterday and what happened in the first couple of months of the season.
What a phenomenal lesson to take with you from the beginning of a career. You know, as a talk show host, when I talk about baseball, I can't divorce it from the context very sure. often. But doing the game is an opportunity to do that and to be mindful and to be present. Boog Shambi, who was on last year and is a pal, was talking about how it's kind of a forced mindfulness exercise to go to the ballpark and do the game every day. And with the frenetic pace of all our lives, I wonder if you can relate to that. Because as you're saying, you're doing the game in a vacuum. You have to be present. You have no choice but to be right there in that moment.
Exactly. And, you know, I learned that lesson partially from Frank Messer, who was the voice of the Yankees when I started doing this back in the late 70s and early 80s. And the Yankees then were the Bronx Zoo. And they had all this stuff going on. And there was, you know, always friction between Reggie Jackson and Billy Martin and Thurman Munson. And there were always all sorts of controversies surrounding the Yankees. And I remember asking Frank, how do you handle that? And he said, that's not my job. You know, my job is to do the game. You know, if people want to know about all that stuff, they can do, they can read the papers. They can listen to the shows on the radio. Yeah. My job is to do the game. And I'm going to focus on that. And you're right. That is mindfulness. That's exactly what it is. It's staying in the moment. And, you know, that truly is what play-by-play is. You know, you're reporting on the moment. You're describing the moment. And it is something we need to, you know, make sure we keep in mind as play-by-play announcers.
How has it changed for you through the years? Because there's so much that's timeless. And I love the connectivity through the generations that you're giving voice to that young listeners feel, even if they don't realize that's what they're feeling. Like, it's part of the draw, is this kind of timelessness of it. How has it evolved for you, Eric?
Well, the big thing now, of course, is there's so much information available because of the internet that wasn't available when I started. You know, we barely got press notes back in 1979. We would get a sheet of stats for each team. We would get a sheet that had the standings, and we might get a set of press notes from each team that had a few dot, dot, dots. You know, Buddy Bell has hit safely in 7 straight games. You know, dot, dot, dot. John Matlack has a 21-inning shutout string. And not much more than that. You know, the Rangers media guide was 16 pages when I started doing this. You know, now we've got 16 pages, you know, just on Corey Seager. And it was a lot different. You had to really work to get information back then, to get interesting stuff about the players. You really had to work the clubhouses. You had to spend a lot of time talking to the opposing team's manager and the opposing team's broadcasters, who are still the best source of information about the team you're playing. That hasn't changed. But all of the other stuff that's available, the stuff that's the statistical stuff, the trends that we can find on Baseball Savant and FanGraphs and, you know, all of those, they have made it so easy to come up with information that the job is now more a matter of deciding what's actually pertinent, what's actually information, and what's just a bunch of numbers that, especially on radio, are too hard for the listener to digest. Yeah. So it's really become a matter of filtering out the information and using what's actually interesting, as opposed to how am I going to get enough information to fill the gaps?
Well, yeah, that makes all the sense in the world. A weird analogy maybe, but it's how my mind works. Beck, who made some great albums in the 90s and the 2000s, used to just load up his recordings with everything and then pull out the stuff that he thought didn't matter, you know, just kind of like pull things out. And then what you're left with is better. But your editing choices have changed in terms of what you have to do.
Right.
All right. So I've done 2 games in spring training in Surprise, Arizona against the Rangers. And the first time you had no idea who I was, nor should you at that point. It was one of my first full games ever. I did 4 full games in that spring with Ron Coomer. But you came out of the hallway and you said, well, tell me about your team. You know, and you gave me that chance to talk about the Cubs, like you're saying, that broadcaster. So
that was just so kind. And you're right. Those questions and those moments talking when Tom Hamilton comes up and says, Matt, tell me about your team. You know, it's like you really that's gold in baseball to have those conversations. You learn so much there, don't you?
You do. And it's funny. Vince Catronio was my partner here for 7 years. And when he went to the A's, we decided that we would actually exchange scouting reports via email before we even got to the ballpark at the start of the series, the first time the team has played each other. So we would actually save time. And, you know, especially on the players who we weren't familiar with or players who had changed something, pitchers who had added a new pitch, or, you know, a batter who had drastically changed his stance or changed his the size of his bat or something like that. Yeah. And we actually do that via email. But, you know, getting to hang out with the other broadcasters is one of the things that's really fun. The opposing manager isn't going to tell you that, you know, his shortstop has had problems going in the hole to make plays, or that his right fielder, you know, never hits the cutoff man. That's the kind of stuff that you'll learn from the opposing broadcaster. Which pitcher has a really good pickoff move? Those sort of things. Yeah. Which batters might bunt for a hit? You know, these are the questions that in the regular season, you know, I tend to ask the other broadcasters because there's really no other way of finding out that kind of stuff. They've seen every game and, you know, they can supply that kind of information.
Yeah, they don't have bunt hits on the stat pages. They've got sacrifice bunts, but they don't have bunt hits.
You can search for it. You can find it on FanGraphs.
Oh, you can. Okay.
I know how to find it on FanGraphs. Stats Inc. has it, although I don't have access to Stats Inc. I know people who do. But it's not something that's readily available. And even the bunt hit statistic can be a little bit deceiving because it doesn't tell you how many attempts. You know, every now and then, you know, you'll talk to a team and they'll say, well, this guy's really working on his bunting. And, you know, he'll try to bunt for a hit at least once almost every game. You know, it's a really nice thing to know. It's a really interesting nugget to pass on, you know, to your fans when a guy comes up to the plate for the first time.
Folks, let me tell you how nice Eric Nadel is. March 10th of this year, I'm doing a game in Texas. And I went and kind of reintroduced myself to you, asked you about coming on the pod. You were kind enough to give me your number. I texted you. And then about 3 minutes before the game, and because that had been maybe an hour before the game, 3 minutes before the game, you texted me a nugget about the home plate umpire, James Jean. Parents are Haitian. He's from Clearwater, Florida. Totally unnecessary, but a lovely gift from broadcaster to broadcaster. That's on the front end from Eric. On the back end, after I'd done the game, you said, how'd it go? And I said, whew. Man, I was a little overwhelmed when the second wave of players came in the fifth inning or sixth inning. And you said, join the club. This is the 45-year veteran saying, join the club, like easing the nerves of an aspiring broadcaster. So that kindness matters. And I wonder if you've already given some of the stories. You felt it early on. Do you feel an obligation to kind of be that way as you go through your career?
Absolutely. That's, you know, the broadcasters who I met when I started doing this in 1979, and I was a converted hockey announcer who hadn't done baseball, were so kind to me. The Yankee announcers, Frank Messer and Phil Rizzuto, you know, treated me like an equal. Ernie Harwell, you know, one of the all-time greats, treated me like an equal. These guys all said, call anytime. You need any advice, you need any help. You know, to a man, they were that way. And when you have an interesting bit of information, you know, like with the umpire, I didn't know how to say his name. I saw him on the sheet. You know, it's James Jean, J-E-A-N, which, you know, there used to be a player, Domingo Jean. So I thought perhaps that he pronounced his name the French way, Jean. And so I went down to the umpire's room, which is very easy to do in our stadium in Surprise. And, you know, all it took was, you know, 5 minutes in there to find out what the deal was, you know, with this umpire, which is, you know, it's to me, it's really an interesting bit of information. You know, Ernie Harwell always gave information on the umpires. He always told you where the home plate umpire was from. And that's something that, you know, those of us who listen to Ernie a lot picked up. And developing relationships with the umpires is very helpful, too, because then when there is a controversial play and you want to go down the next day and find out how the umpire saw it, you know, they're much more inclined, you know, to view you with a smile than if they've never seen you before and you're just showing up to find out, you know, how they screwed that play up or if they screwed that play up. But the background information on players and umpires to me is the really interesting stuff that, you know, the fans aren't likely to have. You know, they might get the statistical stuff, especially people, you know, who play fantasy baseball. And they might go to those websites, to FanGraphs and Baseball Savant, and dig out all the stuff on there. But, you know, you can't get how to pronounce this guy's name by going to those websites. As far as the second wave of players, I used to totally obsess over getting those guys right and knowing something about each of those guys. And then one day, it might have been 10 years ago, I was actually watching a Dodgers spring training game and Scully was doing it, you know, and like Scully is God to all of us. You know, he's the best guy ever to do this and will always be the best guy ever to do this. And he's going through this and the Dodgers in the seventh inning run a whole bunch of new guys out there. And Scully says, and the Dodgers have made wholesale changes. And Andre Ethier is now in center field and Matt Kemp is now in left field. And in right field, we've got number 98. When Scully said that, I said, okay, it's okay to not know who number 98 is. If it's okay for Vin Scully, then the rest of us are off the hook. If we don't know who a couple of these guys are wearing the numbers that are almost three digits.
Oh God, it's so good. It's Scully as God. Yeah, I think that's true for everybody. You know, and obviously true for John Miller, who was on the pod last year. And you know, when guys of your stature and his stature still speak about Vin like that, it gives you that perspective. One of the greatest nights I can remember watching baseball, I think it was Mike Trout's debut, if memory serves, and Scully was doing the game and MLB Network carried it, or maybe it wasn't his debut. It was just early. It was early in Trout's rookie year when it was clear this kid was special. And Scully was talking about when Mantle had burst on the scene and was drawing the parallels between Trout and Mantle. I'm getting chills just thinking about it because it was like, how often do you get a chance to have that living history right there to talk about the context in that way? I wondered what some of the earliest Texas Rangers moments or players, like great players from those early Texas games, still float around your mind and might come up as you're talking about a world championship team, you know, from last year or this year.
Yeah, the comp on the Rangers to the Trout debut and the Mickey Mantle debut was Ruben Sierra. Ruben was the first big signing for the Rangers from Puerto Rico. The Rangers had dedicated themselves to signing players from Latin America. They had signed the famous scout Luis Rosa to sign a bunch of players. They wound up eventually getting Sammy Sosa and Juan Gonzalez. They also had Omar Minaya in their scouting department then. But Ruben was the first one. And the Rangers hitting coach Tom Robson, after seeing Ruben in spring training when he was like 18 years old, had labeled him the franchise.
Wow.
And had said, when this guy gets to the big leagues, you'll know the Rangers have arrived. And when Ruben Sierra first got called up, it was during the season in 1986, he got called up to Chicago and Kansas City. And I think the actual first games he played were in Kansas City. And he had an amazing series. He had an inside the park home run. He had a triple. I think he had six hits in three games. And we thought, well, this is it. You know, our Mickey Mantle has arrived. And that's the one that really stands out for me. And he went on to have an outstanding career. You know, there was one year there that I think it was 1991 where we felt he should have won the MVP and lost out in a close vote to Robin Yount. But he was, you know, he was a guy, a true five tools player, the first one that the Rangers have had, you know, during my time as an announcer, and really even going back to the few years, you know, before I arrived, he was probably the first player the Rangers had who was a legitimate five tools guy.
Yeah, there's magic about guys like that, whether it's Julio Rodriguez when he shows up in Seattle, right? Or, you know, in Chicago now, seeing Luis Robert bloom to his full potential, like when you because your head gets going with all these comps and you talk about stuff like that. Is that so that makes all the sense in the world. The other comp that always comes is Nolan Ryan. I can't imagine what it was like for you to be with the Rangers to see Nolan Ryan age as dominantly as he did.
Yeah, and you know, and he was 40 years old when he came to the Rangers. We still, though, were blown away by the fact that he chose to play for us, you know, a woebegone franchise. And when Nolan arrived, all of a sudden, we had crowds at every hotel. All of a sudden, we had crowds, you know, outside the ballpark as our guys were getting on the bus. Nobody paid much of attention to the Rangers before that. And once Nolan arrived, all of a sudden, it was like, you know, it was like Elvis had joined the Rangers. And that, you know, they we were somebody. But the other debut, I guess that's really noteworthy, you know, for us was Pudge Rodriguez. Pudge got called up when he was 19. He got called up from Double A to actually play a game at Comiskey Park. And I remember interviewing Pudge in the dugout before that game. And his English was not great, but it was good enough. He said, I want to do the interview in English. He was 19. And he was called up because our catcher, Gino Petralli, had gotten hurt. And Pudge was just going to be there for 2 weeks. And I asked him in the pregame show, you know, have they said anything to you about how long you're going to be here? Because, you know, Gino's only supposed to be out for 2 weeks. And Pudge said, yes, they told me I'm only here for 2 weeks. And he looked me right in the eye and he said, but I tell you right now, I never go back to the minor leagues. And he was right. He never went back.
Wow.
He threw out two would-be base stealers that night. And when, you know, held his own offensively, the arm was unlike anything we'd ever seen. And he was catching Kevin Brown and Charlie Huff and Nolan Ryan, you know, three guys who were really tough to catch. And, you know, within 2 weeks, he was the Rangers' everyday catcher. You know, Gino came back and assumed a backup role.
If I were to ask you about, you know, one of your favorite Nolan moments in the booth that maybe we could go find, that felt special, and you feel like, you know, from a play-by-play perspective, it really came together for you as well. Is there one that comes to mind?
Yeah, the biggest moment for me was his 5,000th strikeout, which came in 1989, and the Rangers. It was the brainchild, really, of John Blake, the Rangers PR director, who decided to make this a big deal. You know, nobody had ever made it a big deal when someone got to 4,000 strikeouts or 3,000 strikeouts, but they made 5,000 strikeouts sound like it was, you know, some notable achievement. And people bought it. The media bought into it. And the Rangers published this list of every one of Nolan's strikeouts and how many times he had struck out each guy and how many father-son combinations he had struck out. And everybody went gaga over the 5,000 strikeout. And back then I was doing the middle three innings. Mark Holtz was my partner. He did the first three and the last three. I did the middle three. And I was lucky enough that the 5,000 strikeout fell in one of my innings.
This is the third full count in a row for Ryan. Here's the payoff pitch. He struck him out swinging. Strikeout number 5,000 is history for Nolan Ryan. Cruder brings the baseball to the mound, and the Rangers converge from all over the field. The infielders and outfielders are surrounding Nolan Ryan on the mound.
On August 22nd, 1989, I'll never forget the date, and the game was not televised locally. The Rangers back then, you know, didn't do home games on TV with rare exceptions. So my call of the 5,000th strikeout was what was carried on national media. My parents got to hear it on the Today Show the next day, which was the only time, you know, up to that point that in New York they had heard a call that I did. You know, it was before radio calls were, you know, were everywhere. Nationwide. And that one was interesting because I'd never had a real big moment like that. And I knew, you know, from listening to baseball my whole life, that the thing to do at some point after it occurred is to just shut up and lay out and let the crowd tell the story, since, you know, it was happening in a home game. And I knew it would be crazy when he got the strikeout. But when he got the strikeout and I was getting ready to shut up, the whole Ranger team ran to the mound And we hadn't anticipated that. And I felt that as the radio announcer, it was incumbent upon me to describe what I was seeing, to describe what was happening. So instead of being able to lay out, I needed to describe the fact that the Rangers had all left their positions, you know, and were sprinting to the mound to congratulate Nolan. And eventually I got to the point where I could shut up for a while, you know, and let the crowd tell the story. But, you know, talking about how all of the players were heading to the mound, you know, painted an amazing word picture that, you know, the people at home, you know, wouldn't otherwise have been aware of.
That's really cool. I've got a list of like the greatest baseball trivia questions that have ever come my way. And I just called it up. 7 father-son combinations struck out by Nolan Ryan. I'm sure you knew him then. Any come to mind just for fun? We'll throw this.
Oh, the Alomars do.
The Alomars. Yep.
And one of the reasons is that Roberto Alomar was the final out in Nolan's 7th no-hitter.
Oh, wow.
His 7th and final no-hitter against the Blue Jays.
There you go. Yep. Griffey, Bonds, Alomar, McCray, Hal and Brian McCray, the Franconas, the Wills, and Schofield. That's the one I didn't get, is Schofield. It's so, all right. So that was the biggest moment of your career at that point. I'm sure in 2011, you thought you were about to have some huge ones again. Yes, I'm going to take you right to the darkness, Eric. I'm going to take you to the darkness, because I mean, what was that like? I mean, I imagine you think of David Fries more than you think of the end of Game 7, kind of like people think of Carlton Fisk in 76, you know, more than anybody thinks of Game 7, things like that. What comes to your mind?
Yeah, Game 6 is a complete nightmare for Ranger fans. I can think about it now without getting sick to my stomach, now that the Rangers have won. Up until November 1st of last year, when you mentioned Game 6 of 2011, it really did make me start to feel nauseous. Having had the opportunity twice to close out a game with one strike needed and then not closing it out, first because of the David Fries shot that Nelson Cruz didn't catch, and then, you know, a very lucky bloop single by Lance Berkman that tied the game the second time after Josh Hamilton had hit a home run, you know, in the top half of the 10th inning. But, you know, I was somewhat prepared for a final call before the freeze shot that Cruz didn't catch. I had scribbled down a couple of notes on things that I wanted to make sure to say, you know, after the Rangers had won, just in reference to the number of years it had been and that sort of thing, without actually scripting the call, but some information that I wanted to make sure that I passed on. And then when the fly ball to right wasn't caught and the game was tied, I crumpled up the piece of paper and I threw it underneath the counter. When Josh Hamilton hit the home run in the top of the 10th inning that put the Rangers back in front, I crawled underneath the counter and found the crumpled up piece of paper and uncrumpled it and put it on the desk next to my scorebook, only to throw it under the counter again when Berkman had that bloop single that tied the game in the bottom of the 10th. And then I never went back to it when David Fries hit the walk-off in the 11th, and that sent us home. But going to St. Louis, I think we've gone 3 times since that World Series, has always been kind of unpleasant. The broadcast booth is located slightly over on the third base side so that we stare directly at right field. There's a golf sign on the fence there where Nelson Cruz did not catch the fly ball that as of last time we were there, which was a couple of years ago, is still there. It's like they might as well have painted a chalk outline of Nelson Cruz on the warning track to remind us what happened in front of that golf sign.
Oh God, I'm so sorry. So sorry to make you relive it. My God, well, but then we get to last year, the 12th anniversary of that game is game one of the World Series, one of the great World Series games of all time.
Yeah.
You know, with Seager.
Unbelievably.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we will go to St. Louis this year, and I'm looking forward to going and, you know, not having my heart, you know, up in my chest and, you know, feeling nauseous looking out at right field. I know I can handle it right now. I haven't gone back and watched the freeze hit on a replay, but I think if it came on TV now when I was watching something, I wouldn't turn away the way I always have in the past. And now that the Rangers have won, it's like the pressure is off. I know all you Cubs people probably felt the same way after 2016. You know, maybe we'll win another one, maybe we won't, but the pressure is off. And it's like now we're playing with house money.
Yeah, you know, we should talk about your final call when the Rangers did win it last year, because all of that context was in there.
Two balls, two strikes. Spores kicks and fires. He struck him out looking. It's over. It's over. The Rangers have won the World Series. Ranger fans, you're not dreaming. The Rangers are the World Series champions. After 52 years in Texas, 63 years of the franchise, the wait is over. And the celebration has begun.
Did you have the piece of paper? Was it a similar kind of paper? Did it? It never got crumpled. It never went underneath the console this time.
No, fortunately, they didn't go under the console. Marcus Semien made sure of that with the home run he hit in the top of the ninth. It made it 5-0.
The 0-1. Semien lines one deep to left center field. That ball is way back, and that ball is history. A two-run homer for Marcus Semien. It's 5-0 Rangers in the ninth.
On the piece of paper, all I had scribbled down during the day, because the whole day I felt that I was dreaming. The Rangers were up 3-1. You know, we felt they had a far superior team to Arizona. But still, even the Rangers can screw this up. But I felt I was dreaming that the Rangers might actually be winning the World Series tonight. And at one point, I was sitting in my room and I grabbed a piece of notepaper, it was the Arizona Biltmore, and scribbled on it, "You're not dreaming." And I put it in my wallet. And when I got to the ballpark, I stuck it in the back of my scorebook. And when Semien hit the home run in the top of the ninth to give the Rangers some breathing room, I got that piece of paper out and I put it next to my scorebook to make sure that when the game ended, at some point, I said in the call, you know, Ranger fans, you're not dreaming. Because that's really what it felt like to me. You know, this is the Rangers. This can't possibly really be happening. And as it turned out, you know, that really resonated, you know, with people. So many people have come up to me since then saying, you know, you captured it perfectly by saying, you know, Ranger fans, you're not dreaming. And not only did I not have to crumple up that note, but we auctioned off that note for charity along with my headset from the game, which was falling apart. I'd used it for 10 or 12 years. And we auctioned those two things off and they went for $15,000 raise money for the Suicide and Crisis Center in North Texas. And so that's the story has a happy ending when it comes to notes for final World Series calls.
Yeah, it does. Wow, that's amazing. I didn't realize that charity meant something to you specifically, because it's interesting. Last year, what you had to take, you took a leave of absence that you were open and honest about, which was, and that's very powerful to share that kind of stuff in terms of anxiety and depression. Is there some sense of karmic significance that the year that you address that or deal with that is the year that you're back and get to live this World Series championship?
Yeah, I think so. It's almost as if it were a Hollywood script, you wouldn't believe it. You know, announcer misses the first half of the season because he's got anxiety and he can't sleep. And then he comes back and actually gets a chance to do a World Series winner after, you know, working for 45 years in this job. It's almost too much to be believed. But, you know, I feel so blessed. I feel so grateful. And, you know, a lot of people have contacted me saying that, you know, the fact that, you know, I talked openly, you know, about going to therapy and trying different forms of treatment had led them to do the same. And that's amazingly gratifying. You know, I don't wish depression, anxiety, insomnia on anyone. But having gone through it, at least probably had some positive benefits for a significant number of people. And, you know, I'm glad to say that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I even just you know, my 4-day immersion every once in a while into spring training. I mean, or if I'm spending a few days with the team, the lifestyle and the fact that the stories, they feel like they ought to continue into the night, and they often do with whatever goes with the night. My goodness, it's an overwhelming lifestyle in some ways, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, you kind of get used to it. You get used to the rhythm of it. It's a little different for me now that I don't do all the games. This year I'll do 100 games, and I'll basically have a week off every month. And that's kind of how I'm approaching it. And I'll see, you know, I'm 73 years old. I'll see if that's the right number of games for me, or if perhaps I want to do more games next year, or I want to do less games. I don't know, but we're going to give this a shot this year and try and balance the baseball lifestyle with some sort of normalcy for at least a third of the season anyway.
You've given us some incredible moments, and we'll go grab the highlights. But I wondered if there's, if I could ask you for another from through the years, could be in a year that was not as consequential, or in a year that was and was almost great, or just some moment where you felt like the play-by-play moment came together, some moment that you're proud of where like either the information coalesced or just the feeling was there. And you're like, man, we got that one right at the end of the ball game.
We haven't talked about the 30-run game yet, have we?
No.
Okay. August 22nd, which amazingly, same date as the Nolan Ryan 5,000 strikeout, August 22nd. But in 2007, at Camden Yards in Baltimore, the Rangers defeated the Orioles 30-3 in the first game of a doubleheader.
I forgot.
The Rangers were trailing 3-0 after three innings. They wound up winning 30-3. The pitcher who finished the game, Wes Littleton, worked the final three innings and got a save for protecting a 27-run lead. And in the ninth inning, it was 27-3. And our number nine hitter, Ramon Vasquez, hit a 3-run homer, giving him 7 RBIs for the day and getting the Rangers to 30 runs. And that call was one of the most joyful calls, at that point probably the most joyful call that I had ever made. Victor Rojas was my partner, and the two of us could barely even contain ourselves. You hear, if you listen to the call, you'll hear Victor in the background doing a Ron Santo, Ron Coomer thing, where he just could not contain his enthusiasm. And I barely could either.
The 1-0 pitch.
Swung on a high drive, deep right field. Back goes Peyton. It is history. A 3-run homer. Ramon Vasquez. The Rangers have scored 30 runs tonight. Absolutely unbelievable. It is 30-3.
Unbelievable.
It is the highest scoring game in modern Major League history for one club.
They're on their feet here at Camden Yards.
Vasquez with his second 3-run homer. He has 7 RBIs, as does Saltalamacchia. 30 runs on 29 hits.
The irony of that game, that whole thing happening, was the Rangers were completely out of contention. It was, you know, late August. The game meant nothing. And Ron Washington, for the doubleheader, had decided that so that he wouldn't be tempted to play his regulars in game two if they didn't win game one, he was only going to play the regulars in game two. So he played all of the spares in game one. He handed the lineup to Rudy Jaramillo, the hitting coach, for the hitters meeting. And Rudy looked at the lineup, and he looked at Wash, and he said, "Wash, this is the kind of lineup that gets managers fired." They went out and scored 30 runs, a major league record, with Jared Saltalamacchia, who was a raw rookie catching. I believe he drove in 6 runs. Travis Metcalf played third base instead of Michael Young, hit a grand slam. So the lineup with all the backup players scored 30 runs. First game of a doubleheader. Then the second game of the doubleheader, the Rangers won, I believe, 8-5. And the game took even longer than the first game. after which we flew home, getting home at about 5 a.m. and having to play a night game in 100-degree weather in an open air stadium that next night.
Oh my God. I was just about to look up whether you won the second game or not when the regulars finally got, you know what? Now it's our turn. Let's put up 31. Let's go. Oh God. So, so good. All right, Eric Nadel, you've been incredibly generous with your time. I've got a few questions that I like to ask towards the end. A broadcaster you admired in your youth, and one you admire now. You already gave me a bunch from your youth. So, Mel Allen.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't mention Marv Albert, because growing up in New York, when I was in high school, Marv was doing radio for both the Rangers hockey games and the Knicks basketball games. He had this sweet deal where he didn't travel. Back then, they did radio on the home games and they did TV on the road games. And Marv would just do the radio on the home games. And he was so good. He was the one that kind of cemented my desire to be a play-by-play announcer. Wow. And I would make sure when I got home from school in the afternoon, I would get all my homework done in time to listen to Marv that night, whether he was doing the Knicks or the Rangers. And I've had a chance to meet Marv and tell him how much of an impact, you know, that he's had on me. And I've told Kenny a million times. And like so many kids from New York, I wound up wanting to do this, you know, largely because of Marv Albert. But as far as announcers who I admire now, my first broadcast partner was John Miller. In 1979, John was spending his second of 2 years with the Rangers before he moved on to Boston and Baltimore and then San Francisco, and of course with Sunday Night Baseball mixed in there. But John, to me, is the best announcer of my generation. And I still love listening to the Giants more than any other broadcast. Like when I'm on my way home, you know, they're frequently playing on the West Coast, and I get a chance to listen to John and Dave Fleming and Dwayne Kuiper sometimes on the radio as well. And, you know, I really love the way he does it. The way that he uses his voice and the way that he transmits that enthusiasm and that joy of being at the ballpark, you know, I think is really, really special. And he's not a guy who relies on a ton of information. He doesn't give you a whole lot of statistical stuff. You know, he gives you the game. He gives you a great description of the game, paints a great word picture, and his reactions are important too. You know, when kids ask me about doing play-by-play, I tell them that, you know, the art of it is observe, describe, and react. And that's the key to the play-by-play. Obviously, you have a lot of time to fill on a baseball broadcast, and how you do that is important. But it's the use of your voice, the use of your personality that I think really endears you to the audience. And I think John does that more and more effectively than anybody else.
That's great stuff. My favorite thing I learned, I think, from talking to John Miller last year was that when he was a kid playing Strat-O-Matic baseball with his friends and they would go to each other's houses for road games and home games, he would sing the national anthem at his own home, which I think is just.
Well, just, you'll have this, but my longtime partner, Mark Holtz, who grew up in the Chicago area, would have his father play the national anthem on the organ. And Mark grew up a huge fan of Jack Quinlan. Jack was doing the Cubs back then when Mark was a kid. And he would imagine himself being Jack Quinlan, and his dad would actually play the national anthem on the organ they had in their house.
Man, whatever it takes. That's awesome. The perch is special up there where you get to sit, Eric, from behind the plate, different heights in different ballparks, of course. But what is something you can see from where you work that you think fans would really, really enjoy if they got to sit there and watch the ball games?
Well, it's interesting. And you mentioned different heights. And, you know, where we sit in our new ballpark is very high up. It's not quite as high as Pittsburgh and Washington, you know, which are at the top of the upper deck. But we are in the upper deck, very similar to Atlanta as, you know, what I would rate the third highest. And as a result, I don't really see a whole lot of things that fans can't see because I am up so high. When we're in a lower location, like for us, we go to Anaheim for, you know, two series a year, used to be three. We're really close to home plate. like we were when I got started in all the stadiums. You know, you're still in that perfect sweet spot of the first row of the second deck, you know, which is really, for me, where you should be. If they weren't trying to sell all these good locations now as luxury suites, which I certainly understand. But there, you know, I can actually see the movement on the pitches. Yeah. You know, I can identify the pitches without guessing, without using a monitor. And, you know, that's the thing that, you know, I wish that all fans had an opportunity to do. I wish they had an opportunity at least once to sit in those seats and see how much different it is. You know, in those old ballparks, you know, people have probably talked to you about Tiger Stadium and how the booth in Tiger Stadium almost overhung the backstop. It was that close to home plate where we would sometimes hear things that were said at home plate.
Wow.
And, you know, those were amazing days. You really had to duck fast if a ball was hit straight back at you. But you were so close to home plate, you know, you never felt more in the game than that.
Is there a specific item that you like to always have with you in the booth? Could be a good luck charm or a talisman or anything that has to be there for you.
No, not really.
How about for scoring? What do you use for your scorecard and what implements do you use?
It's interesting. I use a pen. I use a blue pen, standard Bic blue pen, not a fine point. I want the full width. I use red for outs. So if a guy is thrown out stealing or he's erased in a double play, I'll use red to indicate that. I've got a yellow highlighter. If there are notes that I want to highlight, make sure that I get them in at some point.
Oh, red for an out on the bases, huh?
Exactly.
That's super. That's a great tip. That's a great idea.
Yeah. And those are the three basic things that I need to have.
Okay.
I've also, since I do use pen, you know, I've got one of those erase sticks for when they change the lineup, you know, 15 minutes before the game starts.
Got it. Yeah. Joe Castiglione said, whiteout. I need my whiteout.
That's it. Right.
Yeah,
whiteout.
You've got the whiteout stick now, yep. Which is an easier implement. I don't know if he's still a guy who uses the bottle or not. What is one part of your game prep that you can't ignore? Like, I have to do this before every single game or else I feel naked when the game starts.
I like to know what the pitcher throws. You know, I want to know, and it's so easy now with Baseball Savant to find out not only what the pitcher throws, but the percentage of time, what the batting average is against the pitch, what the average velocity is of the pitch, how often he throws it to righties and to lefties. You know, that's some of the new information that's really become available only in the last few years. That to me is really interesting. You know, I don't want to say it's important, but it's really interesting to me. You know, is this guy a hard thrower? Is he a soft thrower? You know, I also, you know, I want to provide some background information on the pitcher. I want you to know where he went to college, if he went to college, where he was drafted and by which team. And then, you know, if he changed teams, you know, how he got to the team that he's currently with. You know, those are things that going into the game, you know, I want to make sure I have, because I'm going to impart that information, you know, at some point early in the game.
Good stuff. And then wanted to close with asking you for best piece of advice that you got or and that maybe now you give. And you've already given us plenty, but in a couple of parts. One would be mechanically for doing the job itself, and the other would be for in terms of an overall career, you know, because it's incredible longevity that you've had.
Yeah, I think the best piece of advice, you know, for me as a radio announcer was just to make sure you describe things. We get so carried away with the information, with all these reams of stuff that we can use to fill between pitches, that we sometimes lose sight of the fact that people want to know what you're seeing. You know, they're tuning into the radio to get the word picture. And this is something that I think Ernie Harwell was one of the very best at, and one of the ones who always emphasized that when you would talk to him. you know, he'd want to describe things and he'd want to give you some background information on the players as opposed to statistical stuff. He wanted to be able to tell you where the guy was from or what he looked like in the batter's box. We take things for granted now because everything's on TV that people know what a guy looks like. But, you know, when people compliment me on the broadcast, more often than not, it's about how I describe things. It's about the fact that I tell them what color the uniforms are.
Yeah.
You know, Pat Hughes is really good at that, you know, describing the piping on the side of the pants. You know, is he wearing his pants high or low? Are they tight? Are they baggy? You know, do they go all the way to the top of his shoes? You know, these are the kind of things that on radio, I think are important. On TV, obviously, the announcer doesn't have to say that. People can see it. But, you know, that's really important to me. And as far as advice that I pass on, you know, that's one of the things I do. Don't forget, you know, you're painting the word picture and yep. you're there to describe things. The other thing I emphasize when I get recordings from other announcers, you know, young announcers, is you have to have that smile in your voice doing baseball. You don't necessarily need it in football. Every football game is a big event. Every baseball game is not a big event. You know, it's a casual day at the ballpark. And you're there to have fun. You're there to have a good time. You're there to be relaxed. And it's important to not have urgency in your voice at the start of a broadcast if it's just any other game. You want to be relaxed. You want to have a smile in your voice. And that's the way you connect with the audience.
Absolute gold, Eric Nadel. Want to inject this stuff into my veins. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Matt.
A pleasure getting to talk to you.
I appreciate it. This was fun.
There he is, a young, curious, passionate soul in the body of a man who has been with the Texas Rangers for 45 seasons. Amazing. Thank you to Eric Nadel. Next week on the PBP, we go to the Cardinals radio booth, a legendary spot that has been inhabited by absolute immortals like Harry Carey and Jack Buck, Joe Buck, and more. John Rooney is the man these days, and his career is remarkable. A long, successful run in Chicago with the White Sox and now in St. Louis since 2006. A great, sprawling conversation with John that I know you will enjoy in our next episode. My producer on the PBP is Ryan Porth. My collaborator is James Vickery. The theme music comes from the great Kurt Morrison of Tributosaurus. Make sure you find the PBP, Voices of Baseball, on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts. From 2400 Sports, Odyssey, and Major League Baseball, this is Matt Spiegel, the PBP, Voices of Baseball. I'll bring you the people who bring you the game.
Giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor.
Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app. Thanks to Republic Records. This is a national contest.